This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
But I don't think we can talk about this actually too much. I mean, it's such an important topic, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, it's huge. We are what we eat. We are what we drink. Yeah, there are other pillars of lifestyle, good health, sleep, stress management, moving. But diet is just massive and it's so misunderstood.
What do you mean by it being misunderstood?
Well, the information that we get is almost 100% wrong. And that's probably not just diet, but in the whole public health arena. So I heard it said once at a conference, if you take what your government tells you to do in terms of public health and reverse it 180 degrees, you can't go far wrong. And it really is that stark. They say carbs are good, fat is bad. It's the other way around. They say meat is bad, legumes are good. It's the other way around. They say fibre's great. You can't even digest it. They say avoid the sun. It's one of the healthiest things that we can do. I've been looking at this now. I mean, when I was at Cambridge, I started to become fascinated in why we had an obesity epidemic, because I've never met anyone who wants to be overweight, let alone obese. So, like, you know, how is this happening? So I've been really interested in this for a very long period of time. And the more I've looked into it, and you start seeing those plates and pyramids that the government's come up with, then I started trying to understand why would they come up with this stuff when it's just so bad for us. And then you find things like conflicts of interest. They just don't seem to want us to be healthy. That's the only conclusion I've come to, is they really don't want us to be healthy. But then it stood me in great stead, because COVID came along and we got some public health messages that could have seriously harmed us, and I just didn't believe any of them, because I just don't believe anything they say on diet or sun or vitamin D or health or anything. So there was an upside to knowing what's going on.
So what should I eat?
What should you eat? Real food, number one. We shouldn't need to call it real food. They should have to call theirs fake food, and then we can re-own the term food. So what is real food? It's as it's found in nature. So oranges grow on trees, cartons of orange juice don't. Fish swim in the sea, fish in breaded fingers or whatever, they don't. It's a really easy concept. You teach it to a five-year-old. What's the difference between a real food and a processed food? And of course, there's degrees of processing, but just go for the most whole food that you possibly can. So that's rule number one. My second rule is choose that food for the nutrients it provides. And that will drive you down a low carbohydrate, higher fat diet. Because when you look at food, and this is not an opinion, this is just scientific fact, you get a spreadsheet, you go on the food databases that they've got all over the place. I use the USDA one, the United States Department of Agriculture, All Foods Database. I make up a big Excel spreadsheet. I take it per 100 grams, I take it per 100 calories. Two different ways you can compare things. And I just put in, right, what do we need? What do humans need? So we need certain fats. There are two fats that are essential. Body doesn't make them. Omega-6, omega-3. We need those. We need to eat them. We need complete protein. We need vitamins and minerals. So then you look at the foods and you say, what provides what I need? It's just a scientific exercise. This is not my opinion. This is just scientific fact. You do that and you find that the foods that provide what you need in the form that you need them as a human being are meat, especially red. White meat is not so good. Fish, especially oily. White fish is not so good. Eggs, especially the yolk. The white bit isn't so good. And dairy, especially full fat. Now, that should be the basis of any healthy diet. Now, that's practically carnivore. I'm not carnivore. I'm not even really keto. There are many plants that I enjoy consuming. And food is also about enjoyment, not just about health. So I want a big crunchy salad. I want berries with my yogurt. I like dark chocolate. My hubby likes red wine. We both like coffee. There are a number of plants that we happily consume. But that's the essence of a good diet. And then the third rule I give is don't eat all day long. So eat two or three times a day. One meal a day, if that suits you. But this grazing that the government tells you to do, eat, snack, eat, snack, eat, snack. It's a recipe for obesity and type 2 diabetes.
You mentioned red wine. Now, your next answer is going to determine whether or not I end this recording right at this very moment.
This might not go well. I tell you now.
Chat to me. Let's just get this out of the way. Bring it on. tell me about alcohol.
Okay. First thing I have to say, which is where we might fall out, is I don't like alcohol. I don't like the taste. I've never managed to acquire the taste. But that makes me completely unbiased when it comes to alcohol research, because I'm like coffee, I've got a little bit of bias. You know, I have to be aware when I'm bringing bias to my research. So I love coffee. So I'm reading a study that says, you know, coffee is good for you. I'm more inclined to want to believe it. One that says coffee's bad for you, I'm more inclined to want to disbelieve it. So I have to fight any bias that I might be aware of. Alcohol, I have no bias because I don't even like the taste. So if the data say you should drink alcohol, then I need to go with the data. And actually the reality is the worst group to be in is the non-drinker group. There's a U-shape in almost all alcohol research. And you might immediately, you've got some smart listeners jumping to the fact, well, oh yeah, but the non-drinkers might be former alcoholics. There might be something else going on. No, even when they take out that nuance of the former alcoholics or people who are not drinking because they've got other serious health problems, even when they take all of that out, the actual non-drinker who's never drunk because they don't like the taste, me, is actually not as healthy as the person who drinks what they call moderately, whatever moderately is. So you've got that sort of U-shape thing. Right, so alcohol and mortality. There was a really, really good study in 2023. If you do show notes, I can give you a link to the dissection that I did on this, because this is what I do every Monday. I take a study and I dissect it so that you guys don't have to. So great study. It looked at 107 what we call population studies. Now, population studies are not as good evidence as intervention trials. So an intervention trial should be, we take 10,000 people and say, don't drink for the next 10 years. And we take 10,000 people and we say, drink a bottle of wine every night for the next 10 years. And then we compare what happens to them. Nobody's going to do that as a trial because they'll say, oh, it's unethical. They're all going to, you know, die of liver disease or whatever. So we have to just look at populations. So 107 population studies, and there were some really interesting findings. And they were looking at mortality as well, which is the thing that counts. You know, some of them will look at a marker like cholesterol or like flow mediation dilation or something like that. Don't look at markers. Look at what counts, heart attacks, dying. Dying is the most important one. So it was a great study, and it basically concluded that there's not an issue for low or moderate drinkers compared to the non-drinkers. So they're no more sort of healthy. There was a sex difference. So it's better for you guys, it's better for my hubby than it is for women. So when you were getting into the sort of the medium intake, and I can't remember exactly what the units were, it's all on my blog. When you were getting into the medium intake as a woman, you started to show slightly increased mortality relative to the lower intake people. For men, you had to get up to the high intake before you were suffering relative to the low. It was a really interesting study. And I put it into the context of the UK, I think I did US as well, the guidelines that the government give you. I mean, in the UK, it's like, oh, women mustn't have more than 14 units a week. Men mustn't have more than 21 units a week. So I put it into that context. It's like, you can drink way more than they're telling you, and you're not going to have a problem. You know, again, they're just not telling you the right thing. There are some benefits of drinking alcohol. It's very sociable. It's very good for stress relief. People enjoy it. They get home at the end of a stressful day. They have a glass of wine. They feel better. That is valuable. Of course, there's things like antioxidants, resveratrol, and some other good things in it. So, you know, don't just dismiss it all as a really bad thing. So that's a quick summary on alcohol and mortality. You can probably go a bit higher than you think. You can definitely go higher than the government is telling you to go.
So basically what you're saying, Zoe, is that I can drink my wine and my whiskey.
Definitely wine. Whiskey is quite interesting because you're getting stronger with whiskey. You're getting lower carb with whiskey, but you're getting stronger with whiskey. And I mean, it's. I hate the word in moderation. I would never use that, but it's kind of be sensible. You know, a bottle of wine a night is really not going to be great for you. But if you're having a couple of glasses of wine a night, the evidence is not saying that that's going to be a problem. That's very much how the French drink and the Italians and the Spanish. And, you know, we keep eulogising about the Mediterraneans as, aren't they super healthy? We've got to take the whole diet. You can't just say, you know, they eat some olive oil, which they do. You've got to take the whole diet.
I want to go back to diet in a moment, but let's just quickly stay on this one. You mentioned a few days ago in one group that I'm in with you, something about the timing matters of when you drink alcohol.
Yeah, so there was a chat in a group that we're both in, and I won't name names, but it's a fellow South African, was interested in what's going on with alcohol and weight. And if I can remember the four things, because it's really interesting. Alcohol and weight, first of all, isn't about calories, because you cannot actually store alcohol in the way that you can store carbohydrate or you can store fat. The body just doesn't, it can't sort of just accept it in that way. It sees it as a toxin and it wants to get rid of it. So that's what it's trying to do. So I'd say don't worry about the calories in alcohol, because your body is not going to be trying to store those. Do maybe worry about the calories or carbohydrates. I'm not a big calories person. I'm more of a carbohydrate person. You might want to worry about some of the things that alcohol comes with, which is why wine is much better than beer. Whiskey is probably not too bad, so long as you're not having other drinks with it. Some people have whiskey and ginger or whiskey and orange or something like that, and then you're bringing something else to the table. So this sort of preferential burning, where the calories do come in, and again, I hate calories, but they're just a unit of energy. So where they come in is because the body sees alcohol as a toxin, it wants to get rid of it first. So let's say you're having a couple of glasses of wine with some pasta. The body is going to use up the calories in the wine. Just think of calories as petrol. It's going to use up the petrol in the wine before it uses up the petrol in the pasta. So if you've had 600 calories of pasta, 600 fuel units, you're going to be burning the 200 fuel units from the wine first. So it's going to take you longer to get rid of that pasta. So that's where it might have an impact on weight. But to me, the most interesting thing about alcohol as the actual substance, not the hops or whatever that it comes with, is that there's two hormones that are trying to keep our blood glucose even in an incredibly tight range, like 4 grams of glucose in your entire bloodstream at any one time. That's 1 teaspoon of glucose. And there's two hormones trying to achieve that. And that's insulin and glucagon. And if your blood glucose goes high because you've just had an apple, then insulin is going to be trying to take the glucose out of the bloodstream, and it will store it as glycogen, stores it as carbohydrate. If you don't use it up, it turns to fat, which is why high carb diets make you fat. The other hormone that's trying to get your blood glucose level back up into the normal range is the one called glucagon. So at about 3 o'clock in the morning, assuming you have a sort of normal eating pattern and you're not binging on, 10,000 fuel units a day, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, your blood glucose level will naturally dip. And that's when your body calls upon glucagon to say, hey, it's getting a little bit below that 4 grams. Go and put some glucose back into the bloodstream. And glucagon does that by breaking down triglyceride, which is basically breaking down body fat. So when people say, how do you lose weight? It's like you have to create the circumstances in which glucagon can do what it's designed to do. Weight is nothing about calories. Weight is about getting your body in the physiological state that it needs to and wants to break down body fat. Now, alcohol inhibits the operation of glucagon, and that's its major impact on weight. So you have a couple of glasses of wine in the evening. When you get to about 3 o'clock in the morning and the body's saying, hey, let's get the glucose level back up to normal, if you've still got some alcohol in the body, if the body is still prioritizing the processing of the liver, basically, it's prioritizing the processing of that alcohol, the liver is not going to be waking glucagon up to do its thing. It's just like, hey, look, I'm sorry, glucagon, I'm busy over here dealing with the alcohol. So you can just have your blood glucose go lower. So let's say you started drinking quite early in the evening. That's when you're walking back from the bar and you see one of those like burger vans or kebab vans, and they look like shit. Am I allowed to say that? They look like shit in the daylight. But at 11 o'clock at night, when you've been drinking for a few hours and your blood glucose is dropping and you've got no way of getting it back again, that actually looks quite attractive because you're now in a hunger situation. So it can make you crave food, because that's your only alternative way of getting your blood glucose levels back up. So that's one of the problems it's going to cause. And of course, the other one is, let's say you carry on drinking into the night, when you would normally be breaking down body fat at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, it can't do it because it's still processing the alcohol that you were consuming late at night because you were watching a film or something, or at a dinner party. So there's a couple of ways in which it sabotages our ability to get glucose levels back to normal. And it will probably wake you up if at 4 o'clock in the morning you don't have that ability to get your blood glucose level back to normal. You'll probably be woken up, and you'll probably be woken up with the munchies. So alcohol and weight is just fascinating. It really is.
Let's go back to the foundational discussion. Yeah, we can come back to, because I want to ask you about coffee also. But it sounds like a stupid question, but it's on your website. What is food?
What is food? It is a good question, actually, because food has come to mean so many different things. I mean, I don't consider baby formula food. I don't consider seed oils food. I don't consider half the stuff in 80% of the supermarket. I just do not consider that to be food. You know, you turn the packet over and there's 50 to 100 ingredients, none of which you could actually say what they are. It's like a chemistry set. To me, that is not food. So food is something that we need to sustain life. It's something that we must consume so that we can sustain ourselves as human beings. And it's the same for other animals. They have different feeding requirements, but we all need food. And then within that category of food, it's as we covered earlier, there are some things that we must consume. We can't make them within the body. Like, we can make cholesterol, we don't have to consume it. It's so important, the body makes it. But we can't make the essential fats, complete proteins, vitamins and minerals. So we must consume those in our diet.
I guess where I was going with that question is more about macronutrients and micronutrients.
So if we break down, I've got a great coloured chart on my website, actually. So if we break down, forget alcohol, because we've done alcohol for now, but then every other thing that we eat that has a calorie, so not water, basically is in one of three macronutrients. And a macronutrient means big nutrient. It's allegedly things that we need in large quantities. And so we know them as the three macronutrients. We know them as carbohydrate, fat and protein. Now, actually, one of those we do not need in large quantities. In fact, one of those we do not need at all. And that's the one most likely to get you some emails trolling. But again, unfortunately, it's a nutritional fact. It's not my opinion. It is just a nutritional fact. You do need fat because you need to get the essential fats. You do need protein because you need complete protein. Without those two, you're going to be in serious problems, from anywhere from eye damage to muscle damage to death. Without carbohydrate, you're going to have no problem for the rest of your life. In fact, you might possibly be healthier than you are now. You would definitely be healthier than someone who's eating the 400 grams of carbohydrate that the government is advising. So we don't need to consume carbohydrate. And you'll have people writing to you saying, but the brain needs glucose and certain organs within the body or whatever need glucose. Yeah, but we've got the ability to make glucose. It's called gluconeogenesis, glucose new formation or new birth or whatever. So we have the ability to make it within the body. And the body can fuel on many different things. It can fuel on carbohydrate, and it does in everyone who eats a high-carb diet. It can fuel on fat. And if it's fueling on fat, you're basically going to be flicking over into a ketotic state or ketogenic diet state. So you're going to be in ketosis. So the body, particularly the brain, will fuel very happily on ketones. So we don't need carbohydrate. That's the one that we don't need. But all food, I've got this really great, we'll put it in your show notes, I've got this great coloured chart where I say, okay, now we know there's carb, fat and protein. Let's put food into those categories. So on the left-hand side of the chart, I say, is there anything that is 100% carbohydrate? And there's only one thing, and that's sucrose, table sugar. So that's carbohydrate anchored. Is there anything that's 100% fat? Well, yeah, of course there are. There are oils. They are 100% fat. Not butter, because butter has got some protein as well as some fat. It's probably got some water in it as well. And then in that middle section, every other thing contains protein. And that was really fascinating to me, because it is so difficult to become deficient in protein. You can become deficient in good protein by not eating enough animal foods, but protein is in everything from lettuce to steaks. And that's how you look at food within those categories.
You're going to tell me about micronutrients too, but I just want to ask you something quickly. If protein is in just about everything, do vegetarians not have a problem, or vegans, or whatever they call themselves?
They do, because the complete protein, the protein in the form that we need it and in the right balance that we need it. So when we're talking about complete protein, so there are essential fats and then there are essential amino acids, which is what's provided by complete protein. And essentially, there's a little bit of debate, is it 8 or 9 or whatever, but, you know, work on the basis that there are 9 essential amino acids that we must get in our food. Now, I've dissected on my website when you get sort of WebMD saying, oh, chickpeas are just as good as eggs. Oh, no, they're not. You know, so you can go in again and it's just pure. Yeah, but it's just purely factual. So you go in and say, right, what amino acids are delivered by chickpeas? What amino acids are delivered by eggs? And not only does the body want those sort of 9 essential amino acids, it wants them in the right proportion, in the right ratio. So what you find is when you look at an egg or you look at yogurt or you look at meat or fish or something, they're all as the body wants them. That's, you know, it's a really big clue that nature wants us to consume animal foods. And then you look at the ones that are in legumes and they will have one at a slightly deficient level. So of course, you know, let's say you need 100 of a particular amino acid, and let's say legumes only provide 90 for this amount that you're looking at. So of course, everyone would just say, oh, we'll have more of that. Let, you know, have 110 grams of lentils instead of 100 grams. And then you can just bump that one up. Yeah. But then everything else has gone out of proportion. Then relative to that one, you're getting too much of this one and this one and this one and this one. So the body wants those complete proteins in the form that they come from animal foods. And I was veggie for 20 years, so I did not want to find this out. I mean, thankfully, you know, I did lapse into veganism for a short period of time. Thankfully, I didn't do that for too long. But I'm sorry, vegans, you cannot get what you need within macronutrients, let alone before we get on to micronutrients, where the situation arguably gets even worse.
Okay, let's get on to micronutrients.
Okay, so micronutrients. So micronutrients, micro, small nutrients. So arguably things that we need in smaller quantities than the macronutrients. So macronutrients we need in grams. Micronutrients we need in milligrams or even micrograms, MCGs. So within vitamins, there are 13 vitamins. There are the water-soluble vitamins. So that will be the 8 B vitamins and vitamin C. And the interesting thing about the water-soluble vitamins, because we are 60% water, they will be lost from the body with bodily fluids. So they'll be lost in urine, they'll be lost in sweat. So we need to have regular supplies of those because the body can't store them in our water. They're just going to get excreted too regularly or weed out. The fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, the body can store, and it can store in our body fat. But of course, if you're particularly lean, then you're not going to be storing as many fat-soluble nutrients because you just don't have the fat to store all of those micronutrients. And then again, like the macronutrients, the body wants them in a particular form. So let's just take the fat-soluble vitamin, vitamin A, which is incredibly important for hair, particularly eyesight. I mean, I would just say, you know, think vitamin A, which is also called retinol in the form that it comes from animals. Think retina, the eye. I mean, it is just so important for eye health. It's not true. So vitamin A retinol, the stuff the body wants, is found in animal foods. Now, vitamin A comes in a plant form, which is carotene, which is found in carrots and vegetables and quite a few other plant foods, but that's not what the body wants. And the vegans will say, oh yes, but you can convert from carotene to retinol. Well, actually, no, not everyone can. And we know that there are particular groups of people that don't convert very well or don't convert at all. I think type 2 diabetics are particularly poor converters. It might even be all diabetics. But the conversion rate is really poor. So it might be conversion rate of sort of 1 in 6 kind of thing. So the body's crying out for liver, basically, where you get a fantastic providing of retinol. But you just keep eating carrots or plant foods or whatever and, you know, touching wood and hoping for the best that the body's going to convert that into retinol. You'll be in big trouble. It's like vitamin D. The body wants D3, which you can get from sunshine and animal foods. It doesn't want D2, which is what you get from plant foods. B12 you only find in foods of animal origin. The most absorbable form of zinc is found in animal foods. The most absorbable form of iron is found in animal foods. You know, you're dicing with your health if you think you can follow a entirely plant-based diet, go vegan, and get the optimal nutrients that you need in the body. You won't get fish oils in the form that they need. You won't get EPA and DHA, you'll get ALA, and again, you might not be able to convert.
My wife and I actively don't take any supplements. I've got a love-hate relationship with them. Some people say because of some of the food that we buy is deficient in certain nutrients, we need to supplement that with pills or powders. I just don't like that. What is your view on supplements?
I've at a base level, this is quite cruel, but if we had no supplements, there could be no veganism.
Hold on, say that again.
If we had no supplements, let's say they didn't exist, we couldn't have veganism.
That's interesting.
Because you have to, so almost as a fundamental reason, I don't like supplements, because supplements have enabled this whole plant-based movement. Oh, just have a B12 injection, just take a D3 tablet. They won't take the animal-derived fish oil. They won't take the EPA and DHA because it's come from a fish. They will take extra ALA and hope that it will get converted. So you might still be in trouble if you're a poor converter. So if you come across a vegan who seems to be doing okay, and they've been doing it for a long period of time, most vegans stop within about a couple of years because they get health problems. If somebody's been doing it for a long period of time, they will be supplementing thoughtfully, and they will be good converters of the plant-based options into the thing that the body actually needs. So, you know, wouldn't it be lovely if we couldn't have this whole plant-based thing that's been rammed down our throats at the moment because we weren't able to give people B12 injections? So that's at the fundamental level. At a different level, I can see some benefits in some supplements because, rightly or wrongly, and it's wrongly, our soil has degraded so much over the years that all of the food supply is affected by that. So the plants, which are not giving you everything you need anyway, the vegetables are substandard because they're not being grown in soil that's going to give them all the minerals that are going to be helpful to us. But also the animals grazing on the land are not eating the quality of the soil and the microflora that they used to be eating. So that also affects the animal food supply. So there might be an argument, and there might be an argument with certain nutrients. So you live in South Africa, you get a good amount of sunshine, I imagine, for much of the year. Anyone in the UK north of, I think it's Birmingham, they say, you are not going to have the right sort of trajectory of the sun down onto the ground to give you any kind of vitamin D benefit for at least 10 months of the year. And you therefore really need, I think, to supplement D3. If you take D3, you need to take K2 because you want to get the calcium in the body into the right place. You might want to take some nutrients if you're thinking, you know, seasonally or whatever. Some people want to take vitamin C if they don't get enough in their diet. Some people want to take zinc. I'd be okay if you said, I don't want to take any, and you can get sunshine and you eat loads of animal foods and you grow your own vegetables in good soil. You're going to be fine. But most people don't fall into that category, so they could probably benefit from a couple of things.
I go hunting. I guess that's the best kind of meat.
Yeah. Yeah, because it is wild. It's out on the land. It's land that wasn't used for legumes last year in the sort of three-field system. So it won't have been subjected to all the pesticides and the GM monstrosities or whatever. Because, of course, that's the other problem. You know, I walk every morning. I live in the countryside. I walk past a field one year and it's got cows and sheep in it. And then the next year it's got rapeseed in it. I know that rapeseed has got chemicals put on it to try to optimize the crop. It's got pesticides, it's got whatever. And that's all going into the soil that the animals are going to graze on next year. So, you know, I prefer to try to get our meat from the Wye Valley, where I know they're grazing alongside the river much more naturally, like your meat.
I suppose it goes without saying then that you should try support less the sort of franchise stores and try and support more the sort of local farmers markets, etc.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I know my butcher by name. I've known him for 25 years. I know my fishmonger by name. The same. We get our dairy and eggs from the farm shop. We've got people who've got chickens in the village. When they're laying good amounts and they've got more than enough for their family, we're the next refusal. So I know the provenance of our food. I know where our milk and dairy and all the rest of it comes from. And then people will say, oh, but you're really fortunate. You know, I live in the middle of London. It's like, well, that's your choice. You know, I used to live in the middle of London. And when I did live in the middle of London, I didn't have access to the food that I have access to now. Now, I did have access to concerts and the theatre and going out for dinner with more friends, because you've got so many people who live in London. You know, there's pros and cons, but I've chosen for the last 25 years to live in the countryside, to live away from the pollution, away from the noise, away from the light, away from the high population, in the fresh air, where I can go out and walk across the fields every morning. That has been my choice.
I forgot to mention this earlier, so let me just bring it up now, because this will invariably come up in some conversation after this episode has been released. But there's the China study, and of course you have Indians, and you have Chinese people who have these very high carbohydrate diets.
Yeah, I mean, the China study, I do this dissection on Monday Notes, as you know. I also have this general rule that if someone I respect has done a dissection of something, I don't repeat it. You know, Chris Kresser has done the go-to article on should you be worried about nitrates in bacon? The answer is no. Google Chris Kresser nitrates in bacon. There's the article. Denise Minger is the person who has done the go-to on the China study. I think she's on the spectrum. I think we're all on the spectrum, aren't we? People who question things and just don't trust in it. I think we're all on the spectrum. And the detail and the rigor and the systematic approach that she took to the China study was just breathtaking and just basically blew it apart. I mean, so much of it is based on population evidence. So, you know, we haven't got into the sort of the hierarchy of evidence of what's good evidence and what's bad evidence. But so much of the evidence in the nutritional world is what we call population studies. So it's not a randomized controlled trial. It's not that one that I said in alcohol, where you get 10,000 people drink, 10,000 don't drink. Let's see what happens in 10 years. That would be a good level of evidence. No, what they do instead is to say, oh, OK, we took the nurses in a US population study. And this is true. This is where most of the Harvard stuff comes from. Oh, we'll take the nurses' health studies. So we recruited loads of nurses who are quite particular people anyway, probably a different profile to the average female in the population. And then we'll take the health professionals for men. So it's basically male medics and female medics. And we'll recruit loads of them. We'll get loads of information on them. What's your BMI? How much do you exercise? Do you smoke? Do you drink? What's your diet at the beginning of the study? And then we'll follow them over 20 years. Now they've been following them for about 40 years. And they look for associations. So they say, who ended up getting lung cancer? Oh, look, the people who smoked were six times, let's say, more likely to get lung cancer. Okay, you've now found an association, which you're supposed to then go and test in randomized controlled trials. Now, with something as strong as smoking and lung cancer, I mean, it's probably something like a factor of 20, not six. You just say, okay, that's almost certainly causal. Call off the dogs. Just if you don't want to get lung cancer, probably a good idea not to smoke. But they end up with something like a 10% difference of, oh, the people who were eating legumes were 10% less likely to, I don't know, have this particular marker or something. Or they might claim 10% less likely to have heart disease. And then you say, okay, so who are the kind of people who eat legumes? Particularly back in the 1960s when you started this study, you know, nobody had heard of lentils and pulses and celebrity chefs and all this kind of thing. So people who were eating legumes then were pretty health conscious people to have worked it out. And anyone who eats nuts is pretty health conscious. They say, oh, nuts make you healthy. It's like, no, they don't. Healthy people eat nuts. It's completely the other way around. So you can't jump from association to causation. But that's where almost all the evidence comes from in the nutritional world. So we've just done a quick tour through epidemiology, why it's not going to tell you anything. And that's where most of our sort of so-called evidence comes from. And the China study very, very much rested on population evidence, Chinese people eat lots of carbohydrate and Chinese people don't end up getting loads of heart disease. Well, your average BMI in China during the time that this was being looked at was fantastically different to the average BMI in US. So you can't say, well, look, the US people have, you know, eating burgers and the Chinese people are eating stir fry and noodles. Oh, and look, these are just so much healthier. It's like, you know, where do you even start? You know, the US people have got twice the BMI. You know, they drink more, they're more stressed, they've got fewer days of holiday. They don't have the family kind of culture that the Chinese do. They're not out in the 1960s, still working in the rice fields, doing 8 hours of exercise a day. You know, you are literally comparing chalk and cheese and then trying to put it all down to the carbohydrate intake. There's probably about a thousand other things that are going to make those two populations different.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. So there are so many varying factors involved.
Yeah. And they say, oh, we adjust for those. And I always say, you cannot adjust for a whole person. So there's a person over there who is affluent, educated, they have a lovely lifestyle, they've got a good income level, they're not worrying about the paycheck at the end of the week. They eat legumes, they eat nuts, they're slim, they're healthy, they've got children called Tarquin and Olivia. And then you've got the woman in the Bronx who's trying to bring up six kids by five different dads and fighting the housing association and fighting five ex-husbands or whatever, maybe suffering abuse, maybe hating her job, no money to make ends meet. And they then say, oh, you know, everything is down to the diet, the different diet between those two people. You know, she's eating burgers and they're eating legumes, and it's down to the burgers and legumes. And that the characteristics table in population studies is the one that you go to confirm what I've just said. And they're like, oh, look, the person who eats meat, less educated, less affluent, higher BMI, drinks more, smokes more, doesn't eat other healthy things, et cetera, et cetera. And then they try to adjust for all of that. And they say, oh, we've adjusted for it. We've now got it down to just the burgers versus the lentils. And I just want to sort of find the nearest wall and bang my head against it and think, if you honestly think you have adjusted for the entire difference between those two people, such that you can now say that everything health-related is down to the burgers versus the legumes, you shouldn't be in academia. You know, you are literally too stupid for us to be continuing this conversation.
Zoe, when we talk about losing weight, what are we talking about?
Sorry, just popped up on my screen. Right, what is weight loss? Weight loss, we touched on it earlier. So weight loss is breaking down body fat. So then you say, well, what is body fat? Body fat is what we call a triglyceride structure. So when you just see the word tri, start thinking three, tripod, tricycle, and so on, trimester. So tri means three. So triglyceride is basically, it's a backbone of glycerol with three fats attached to that glycerol. And that's basically what body fat is. So you've got this whole calorie theory group who say, oh, so long as you eat fewer calories, the body is just going to break down body fat. And I'm like, no, the body can only break down body fat in certain physiological circumstances. So we touched on it earlier. Insulin and glucagon are antagonists. If you think of them like alley cats, they're never out in the alley at the same time. So if insulin is doing its thing, glucagon is not there. If glucagon is doing its thing, insulin is not there. Insulin is the dominant hormone. So if insulin is doing its thing, glucagon can't say, whoa, it's my turn. Insulin is the dominant hormone. So to even be in the state that your body can lose weight, let alone that it will, you have to not have insulin present. You have to not have carbohydrate available. So if you've just eaten a croissant, you've got glucose in the bloodstream. And as fast as the body is trying to take it out of the bloodstream because that's toxic, let's say you eat a croissant and then you want to go for a walk. So your body's trying to use up the croissant for carbohydrate because the body is lazy. It will use carbohydrate if it's there. So you're in this situation where you're trying to use it and the body's trying to take it out the same time. And then when the body realizes you need more, it will put some back in. So it's taken some out, it will then put some back in. So you've got this sort of thing going on. The body, if it doesn't have excess glucose in the bloodstream, or if you haven't just eaten carbohydrate, the body will go looking at your stored carbohydrate in the body. And we know that as glycogen. So when insulin is taking glucose out of the bloodstream, it's putting it in this storeroom and it's storing it away as glycogen. So the body will say, all right, okay, blood glucose is dipping a little bit low. Let's go to that 3 o'clock in the morning situation. So body says blood glucose is dipping a little bit low. Insulin's not around. That's good. We've not just eaten something. Glucagon, wake up, go do your thing. So glucagon will say, right, is there anything in the storeroom? Because that's the easiest thing for me to use. So if there's anything in that carbohydrate storeroom, I'm just going to use that. And if you're eating the 400 grams of carbohydrate that the government is telling you to eat every day, I can tell you, you've always got something in your storeroom. You can be eating 500 fewer calories than you think you need, but if you're eating them all in the form of carbohydrate, you are not going to run empty on carbohydrate in any 24-hour period. Trust me on that. So the body's just going to go to the storeroom, use the carbohydrate, and off it merrily goes. But you have not lost any body weight. That there has been no chance of you losing body weight, because you're only going to lose body weight if the body has to use body fat. It's not going to give that up first. It's going to go for the easy route, which is the carbohydrate. Now, let's assume you're not nuts. You're not even necessarily carnivore or keto, but you're no more than moderate carbohydrate, which Tim Noakes would define as no more than 130 grams of carbohydrate a day. You will use that up in the day period. So you get to 3 o'clock in the morning, glucose going a bit low, body says, glucagon, do your thing. Glucagon goes to the storeroom, it's empty because you've used it up. It then has to look for fat. Now, if you've eaten a lot of dietary fat during the day, you might have dietary fat available, which is why even if you go low carbohydrate, you can't go nuts on fat if you're trying to lose weight. Don't go and eat butter like some sites tell you to do, joke, until the cows come home, because the body will just use the dietary fat instead of the body fat. Let's assume you're sensible, you're not sticking butter on everything. The body then has to go and find some body fat to break down to put some glycerol into the bloodstream. The fats then go into the bloodstream and the body can use the fat for fuel, and the glycerol will keep the blood glucose level topped up. That is the definition of weight loss. The body going to break down that body fat, that is the definition of weight loss. So you have to do the things that enable the body to be able to do that. So what does that mean? Don't eat too much, because, you know, don't count calories, whatever you do, but don't go nuts. Don't stick butter on everything. Don't go too high on carbohydrate. I mean, ideally, don't go over 130 grams a day. You may find if you really want to lose weight, go down to somewhere between 50 or 100, even lower if you really want to speed things up. Make the body have to use fat for energy. Don't go too high on dietary fat, and then it will have to use body fat. And then watch out for things that impair the body being able to do that, which is primarily alcohol. And then your final thing will be, give the body the reason to need some fuel. Now, I'm not saying go out and run a marathon and, you know, anything like that, but use your brain. Read an academic paper, read a Substack article that really makes you think. The brain is a fantastic user of fuel. Go for a walk, hunt, dance with your partner, play with your child, you know, do natural activity. You don't have to go down the gym, which is not a very healthy thing to do in my view, but do some natural things that's going to increase the demand for fuel within the body. Don't have that fuel available as carbohydrate, and then the body's got to go over and look for body fat, which it will happily do.
So when people talk about losing weight, I mean, is there some sort of metric? I mean, is it about simply looking at yourself and going, oh, I'm happy with that?
Well, as in what weight you should be?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good metric, actually. And I think men are much more likely to do that. So I know far more men. I've been helping people to lose weight for over 20 years, and far more men, it will be, I got to the point where I couldn't crawl on the floor and play with my kid. You know, I was so overweight. It was cumbersome. I couldn't get down and then get up safely or easily. So that was their weight loss motivator. And they get to the point that they can play with their kid and they're much more active around the house, and the missus is feeling good about their how they look or whatever. And then they're really happy. Now, they might still be carrying 5 kilos, 10 kilos or whatever, but they're super happy. They've achieved their goal. Women, it's much more likely to be aesthetics. It's much more likely to be about how we look. And I do think women quite often have quite unrealistic aspirations. So I quite often will chat to women who are saying, oh, I just, you know, I'm doing all the right things, but I just sort of can't lose any more weight. And I say, you know, tell me your height, tell me your weight or whatever. You work out the BMI and it's kind of like, you're in the normal range. You know, can you help me understand what your goal is? And then they give you a weight and I put that into the BMI and I'm like, you know, that would give you a BMI of 19. That's probably not healthy. Why do you want a BMI of 19? And so often it's like, oh, I've got this pair of jeans that I wore when I was 18. You know, I want to be able to wear them again. It's like you've had three children since then. You know, that's not going to happen. I'm actually the same way that I was, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. Having worked out how to eat, I find it really easy to stay the same way. I have a belt, this DKNY belt that I absolutely love. And I keep it because it's fascinating. I'm the same weight. And I used to be able to do this belt up over jeans. It doesn't even touch now. And my shape has changed because as you get older, your waist thickens in both sexes, but particularly women. You can be the same weight. You can wear similar clothes, but you are not going to be able to get into those jeans that you were in 30 years ago. Sorry to be the one that brings you the bad news, but expectations need to be realistic. Otherwise, you're just setting yourself up to be disappointed.
Cholesterol, statins.
Sorry, well, I mean, laugh.
I've got family members who, you know, are fighting with this idea of they fear having a heart attack because they're sitting with a cholesterol of 8 or something like that. And so so the doctor will say, no, we need to bring that down.
Where do I start apart from don't laugh? Okay, start with what cholesterol is. If you held cholesterol in your hand, it would be like a vanilla coloured candle had sort of melted on your hand. So it's a sort of creamy coloured waxy substance. That's kind of what it looks like. The chemical formula for cholesterol is C27H46O. So it's a combination of carbon atoms, hydrogen atoms and oxygen, which is what, you know, a lot of stuff in the world is made up of, and the body. First thing people need to know about cholesterol is it is so utterly life vital. I can't even use any words to describe how important it is. It is so life vital that it is not what we call an essential nutrient. You don't have to consume it. It's so important that the body makes it for you. The body is not going to leave it to chance that you're going to get it in food. It's just too important. It is the essence of every single cell that we've got in the body. So if I were able to just go, well, magic, you've got no cholesterol in your body right now, you would be a puddle on the floor. You would have no structure, no form, no cells, no nothing. That's how important it is. It's one of the most important repair tools that we've got in the body. So I think if it is anything, it might be a marker. So I have known people say, oh, my cholesterol is higher than it was at my last test. And I'll say, OK, given that it's a repair tool and the body makes it, the body's making more of it right now because there's something to repair. So tell me what you think there could be to repair. Have you had an injury? Have you been over-exercising? Are you particularly stressed at the moment? What's going on in your life? And 19 times out of 20, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, I sprained my ankle. Or, you know, I broke my leg, or I've had this, you know, chest infection that I just couldn't shift or whatever. They'll tell you something and I'll say, well, okay, your body's trying to repair itself. So, you know, that's why your cholesterol has gone higher. I've done a whole blog on just how inaccurate the cholesterol test is. So if somebody says to me, well, they've got, you know, and I'm glad we use the same units, which is mmol per L. So when you mention that the number 8, that's the units that Europe uses as well. Americans use this mgdl. So there is a normal distribution for cholesterol, just as there's a normal distribution for height. So if you think of female heights, you've got some females who are 4'12" and you've got some females who are 6'4". And then there's a normal distribution. And I can't remember the average height of a woman. It's probably around 5'4", 5'5". But that will be the peak of the normal distribution. And then you've got all people still on the curve. So by definition, anywhere on the normal distribution is normal. That's what a normal distribution is. So the normal distribution for cholesterol will go anywhere from 2 to 3 at the low end up to double figures at the higher end. So if your friend is at number 8 Okay, you're at number 8. Someone else is going to be at number 3. You're both on the normal distribution. It's not abnormal to be on the normal distribution. But the world has decreed that even though the actual norm for cholesterol was probably around 7 to 8 before we started statinating everyone, the medical industry has decreed that we're now going to call 5 high. Well, hang on, like 5 is to the left of the average on the normal distribution. So you're now telling me that everyone else to the right is not normal, they're high. Even people who are average, you're now calling high. Now, why would you do that? Well, probably because statins are just about the most lucrative pharmaceutical until the COVID jabs to come onto the market. So one statin, Lipitor, made by Pfizer, last time I looked, had earned $279 billion for Pfizer. That's one statin, one company. You know, there is a massive industry in lowering cholesterol. I don't ever want my cholesterol lowered. I don't want it measured. I don't care what it is. It's going to be what it's going to be because my body is going to make what it needs to repair me if I need repair. I would worry much more about lower cholesterol personally than I would about higher cholesterol because the brain is using up and hosting about 25% of the cholesterol in the body, which is why one of the side effects of statins is cognitive malfunction, basically. So you get memory loss, mood impairment, you know, mind disturbances or whatever. A lot of people do on statins because you've got so much cholesterol in the brain and you're then going to impair the production of that cholesterol. Not completely, because if you did, you'd be the puddle on the floor. But statins impair it enough to lower cholesterol. Your doctor's then happy, but your body isn't. And that's the short version of the cholesterol view, yes, according to me.
But Zoe, we also take in cholesterol like in eggs.
Yeah, makes no difference. And we've known that forever. So the guy who started looking at this was called Ansel Keys. He did the Minnesota Starvation Experiment, which was published in 1950. Fantastic study. And he then was kind of like the man of the moment, and he wanted to stay being the man of the moment. So he started looking at things like cholesterol, dietary fat, heart disease, particularly in men. And he started off with the premise that cholesterol in food raises cholesterol in the blood. And he concluded really quickly, and there's quite a famous quote of his where he says, cholesterol in food makes no difference to cholesterol in the blood unless you're a rabbit or a chicken. And we've known that all along. So they did some animal experiments, and it does make a difference to a rabbit because a rabbit is a herbivore and cholesterol is only found in foods of animal origin. So to give rabbits cholesterol, you've got to feed them animal foods. But the bunny is a herbivore and you're feeding him something he can't digest. So no wonder he's going to have some bad outcomes. It's got nothing to do with the cholesterol and everything to do with the fact that you gave him food that he can't digest. It'd be like giving your cat or a lion a plant-based diet. You know, they're carnivores. So we've known for ages that cholesterol in food makes no difference to cholesterol in the blood. So don't worry about eggs. Don't worry about animal foods. Don't worry about full-fat dairy. That's where you find your nutrients. If your doctor is insistent that your cholesterol is too high, you can remind them that the normal distribution is where it is. Three things that I sort of look at if somebody's saying, well, my doctor's telling me to go on statins, I still don't want to go on statins, what ammunition have you got for me? Number one, there's a great website called thennt.com, and that stands for the number needed to treat.com. So go on thennt.com, put in statins, assuming you haven't had a heart attack, click on the efficacy for, or the number needed to treat for, without pre-existing heart disease, because you haven't had a heart attack, so you're not pre-existing heart disease. And I happened to look at it this morning, and I think from memory it said, okay, if you've got the number needed to treat is how many people do you need to have on a statin for 5 years for one of them to avoid something. So you need 150 odd people on a statin for 5 years for one to avoid a heart incident, which could be angina, which kind of feels a little bit like indigestion. So then on the same website, they've got the number needed to harm. So how many people do we need to have on statins for 5 years for one of them to suffer harm? Now, we only need 50 for one of them to probably get type 2 diabetes. I think it's we only need about 10 for one of them to suffer muscle damage, which is why people who go on statins talk about muscle pain. They become less active, which has other repercussions on health. So number one, the NNT. Number two is a Christensen paper from, I think it's 2015, where they said all of this stuff about, oh, you need to be on statins because they're going to save your life. Can't save any lives. We're all going to die. So the only question is, by how much longer might you live if you're on a statin? So they did the analysis and said, if you're on a statin for 5 years, you might live an extra 3 or 4 days. But you've got the side effects for the whole 5 years. Now, if the doctor said that to your friend with a cholesterol of 8, look, buddy, I might be able to buy you 3 or 4 days, but I'm going to give you side effects for 5 years. Your friend immediately is going to say, no, thanks, doc. I'll just crack on. And then the third thing that is really helpful is to look at the patient information leaflet. So another confession, I used to work for a drug company and I was on the management team when I worked for the drug company. And if we don't make the information in drugs accurate, by law, we could end up in jail. That's the way it works in the UK anyway. We didn't want to end up in jail, so we made damn sure that the packet information is accurate. So if you know that there are side effects, then you need to put them in the package. As an aside, it was quite interesting that the COVID jabs, nobody was given any package leaflet. They just rocked up at a sports stadium or something and 2,000 people were having their sleeves rolled up and something stuck in their arm and they had absolutely no idea what was going in and no packet information. Separate issue. Look at the patient information leaflet for statins. Look at the things that they report as common side effects. Like 1 in 10 people are going to experience these. The chances are there's some pretty serious stuff in there that you really don't want to get, particularly for that 3 to 4 days extra life. So those are the three pointers that I give people. If you're still under pressure to take a statin, you maybe want a bit of ammunition to talk to your doctor about. And then the final thing is, everything that you take, your relationship with your doctor needs to be built on informed consent, which is again why COVID was so heinous. You know, you're going to have this jab whether you like it or not. If you want to get in a sports stadium or if you want to get on an aeroplane, that's not informed consent. You know, the definition of informed consent in the UK National Health Service is you must not be coerced in any way in coming to your decision. And they specifically list out, you must not be coerced by friends. You must not be coerced by family. You must not be coerced by the medical profession. I have never seen as much coercion as we saw in trying to get people to take those jabs. There was no informed consent given during that era, and it's a crucial linchpin of the way medical systems should work.
I did say I was going to come back to this, and that is coffee. Now, I enjoy coffee. I don't drink instant coffee. I'm a little bit of a snob. I grind my beans, that sort of thing. And I drink coffee with cream.
Nice.
Is coffee healthy or unhealthy?
So we don't have big proper evidence on this. So we don't have the randomized controlled trials. We've only got that population study stuff, which is why I'm really pleased we took the time to explain the population study stuff, because it's like the alcohol. We didn't do the 10,000 people drink it, 10,000 people don't, follow them up in 10 years. We haven't done that. So all we have is population studies. So they would look back at that nurses study and say, okay, let's look at the nurses and let's look at their coffee intake and let's put them into groups. So we'll put them, the bottom group will be people who don't drink any coffee. Then it'll be 1 to 2 cups a day, and then 3 to 4 cups a day, 4 to 5 cups a day, and then maybe more than 5 cups a day. So they literally do put them in those kind of groups. And then you've got everything else going on. So the people who drink coffee, there's a strong association between drinking coffee and smoking, because a lot of people will sit down and have a cup of coffee with a friend and have a cigarette at the same time. People who don't smoke with their coffee quite often have a biscuit with their coffee, or a piece of cake or something. So you've got immediate confounders with coffee. And again, they say, oh, we adjusted for these. It's like, can you really adjust for the person who's having 5 or more cups a day because they're working in the city and they're probably also taking cocaine, which they never ask about, because they're so stressed and they've got such bad deadlines that they've got to be in this, you know, sort of sixth gear at all times. You know, you can't adjust for that kind of thing. So all they've got is, this is what happened to the people who drank the most coffee, and this is what happened to people who drank the least coffee. Now, even having said all of that, I will be able to show you population studies that say coffee is harmful, and I'll be able to show you population studies that say coffee is beneficial. So what do you want to believe? Because I can show you both of those. It's not categorical in the way that jumping off a cliff is universally bad for you.
But also,
you know, that just in.
Sorry for butting in, but also it's not just the coffee. I have cream with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And cream is good, assuming that you're not overweight and you're not consuming too much fat and not giving your body the chance to burn body fat. If you wanted to lose weight, then there's nothing wrong with cream. It's not, you know, if you go back to what should we eat, eat real food, choose that food for the nutrients it provides. You could choose a food that is more nutritious than cream, eggs, yogurt, red meat, oily fish. There are things that are more nutritious than cream, but there are a lot of things that are less nutritious than cream. So it's not a bad choice.
Yeah, and you can't exactly put eggs in your coffee though. So
no, exactly. And food is also about enjoyment. It's a massive part of our lives. It's about family. It's about socializing, breaking bread together. You know, it doesn't have to be bread, but be with friends and, you know, I love nothing better than a dinner party. Absolutely love a dinner party, and you can still be around the table at 4 o'clock in the morning picking at the cheese and you know, whatever is left on the table, you know, debating all the issues going on in the world, and just having great connections. Without food, you wouldn't have that.
Zoe, time is against us. I've got more talking points, but I want to ask you something that always comes up when we're talking about sugar. But you see, if it's from the fruit, then it's different. Fructose versus sucrose. I mean, break this apart.
Okay, carbohydrates 101. There are three what we call monosaccharides. Mono means one, saccharide means sugar. So there are three monosaccharides. They are glucose, fructose, and galactose. And then you've got three what we call disaccharides, two sugars. So let's just take the one that you mentioned, keep it simple. Sucrose is a disaccharide, a two sugar. So sucrose is one molecule of fructose and one molecule of glucose. So when you consume one molecule of glucose and one molecule of fructose, the body has absolutely no idea where it came from. The body just breaks it down into those single sugars. So you could take white sugar from the sugar bowl, which has no nutritional value whatsoever. It has no fat, has no protein, has no vitamins, it has no minerals. It has nothing of any value whatsoever. Or you can have glucose and fructose that comes from a piece of fruit. But in terms of the glucose and the fructose, to the body, it is exactly the same thing. Now, the fruit will come with a little bit more than the sugar, but nowhere near as much as people think. So fruit is essentially sugar and water. And I said this on Twitter quite... Yeah, watermelon. I said this on Twitter recently. Oh, my goodness, the replies that you get. Oh, fruit is really healthy and all the rest of it. It's like, oh, why did I do that? I forgot that, you know, Twitter gets really upset when you say the absolute nutritional fact that fruit is essentially water and sugar. And it's got a couple of nutrients or whatever, but far fewer than people think. You know, it's got nothing in the form that the body needs because it's not an animal food. So, yeah, it's got some vitamin C, but yellow peppers have got more. What else might it have? I mean, it's just nothing to write home about. I would really struggle to think of another thing other than vitamin C that fruit has got. And again, yellow peppers would be better. So I love it. I love fruit. That would be my binge food. If I had a binge food, it would be fruit. Dates, more sugar than toffee. I could eat fruit all day long. It's absolutely delicious. It's crunchy, it's sweet, it's refreshing, it's absolutely fantastic. But it isn't the healthiest choice that you can make. And the body knows not where the sugar came from. So you'll get other things with the fruit, but as far as the glucose and the fructose is concerned, it's the same to the body.
So let's come in for a landing. Let me ask you for a nugget of wisdom.
A nugget of wisdom. I mean, I think the sort of what should we eat? The three things. I mean, that's what I most often say to people. I think we've also had the one that if you could just take public health advice and just flip it on its head is probably then accurate. I think realizing it's the only conclusion that you come to. They actually don't want you to be healthy. It's the only conclusion you can come to because the advice is just so bad. It it cannot be by mistake. You know, there's only when people say something that is just so completely wrong. I've looked at the American Dietary Guidelines recently and they're so completely wrong. You say, well, why is that? You know, are they incompetent, the people who put these together? No, they're professors of nutrition. Are they conflicted? Yeah, there are some conflicts, but that might not be why they did this. You know, it's almost as if there's just too much at stake in terms of the fake food industry, the vested interests. They're going to keep promoting this message because that's the way the world works. That's what keeps people in employment in the biscuit industry and the fizzy drink industry. So they're then just not going to rock that boat. So you just have to ignore it, look after your own health, and keep away from doctors as much as you possibly can. I'm on Twitter. I don't do Instagram because it kind of just feels like you've got to post every meal and I'd just rather eat my meal and enjoy it. So I'm on Twitter. I'm just at Zoe Harkham, which you can see on the screen there. My website is zoeharkham.com. My business is I dissect an academic paper each week so that you don't have to. I've just done my 700th Monday note, so that's nearly 15 years. That's been going. It's like not even a pound a week, I don't think, if you sign up for the year. And then if you come across a study that you want me to dissect, send it in. If a couple of people ask for it, it ends up getting done. So you get that chance as well. So that's me.
Don't judge me, but I am going to enjoy my wife's delicious lasagna this evening.
Oh, good on you. Good on you. You should. You should. A little bit of what you fancy. You're not overweight. You're in great shape. You hunt food. Most of the time you're doing great things. I love a lasagna. You know, we had rice and chili the other night. Someone cooked for us. It was fantastic. Loved it. Food is there to be enjoyed.
Zoe Harkham, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.